Good evening. My name is Bruce Rawls, and I'd like to thank Daniel Holman and Roberta Walker for a great show and for allowing us to fill in this last hour for the Conscious Cafe. You're listening to KVMR FM in Nevada City, broadcasting at 89.5 FM. And we also have translator K257DM serving Sacramento at 99.3 FM. And the new translator we have for Auburn is K27AE at 103.7. So we're going to be doing a little bit of mathematical mysticism here this evening. But first I'd like to invite any of you who may not be members of KVMR to call in during normal office hours. That's 265-9073. And join this wonderful resource that we have for the community here to share wonderful, worthwhile, insightful, and inspiring things. So if you're not already a member, or if you'd like to contribute in some additional way that you might not have already thought of, give the folks at the office a call during normal business hours from 9 to 5 at 265-9073 and give your support to this wonderful station. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce my guest for this evening, Michael Schneider, and he has written a wonderful book called The Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. And he's going to be here in Grass Valley on December 1st at 7 o'clock, giving a talk on that subject, and that'll be at St. Joseph's Cultural Center in Grass Valley at 7 o'clock. We also would like to let people know that kids are free. We want young people to really get involved in this, because I think it's something that really captures the soul of what is transforming our culture in a great way. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got involved in all this and what precipitated the interest in mathematics and our mystical connection with all of that.
Sure. Well, good evening, Bruce. Well, this started a long time ago, about 30 years ago for me. I was in high school, and I had not been a particularly good math student. It was boring paperwork. And a teacher casually mentioned the connections between math and nature and so forth. And I really caught fire. You know, he mentioned the hexagon, the six-sided shape, and is in snowflakes and quartz crystals and beehives. And I thought, wow, what is this? Why is that? So I just did a lot of research over the years, and to understand more of it, I got a couple of degrees in mathematics and Bachelor of Science, and also in math education, and was a school teacher, middle school mainly, for about 11, 12 years. And I kept on researching and looking and observing nature, and I found that the different disciplines, the artists knew about certain proportions and designs in nature, and the architects did, and the botanists did, and the meteorologists did, and the astronomers did, and they all knew their little pieces. And what I saw was that it was coming together. I was collecting enough information and saw that there are just a very, very few patterns that keep recurring in different sizes and different materials, like a troupe of actors, just a small troupe of actors who go backstage and change into different costumes, different materials, different colors, and so forth, and they come out again. But there's just a handful of shapes, as far as I can see, and they constitute a kind of an alphabet of nature. And by understanding why shapes appear where they do, you know, they come up for reasons. There are reasons that certain fruits are spheres, and horns are spirals, and galaxies are spirals, and the triangles in nature and the squares. There are reasons for each of these. They don't just appear randomly. So I wanted to know what's the significance of these shapes, this alphabet, and how then to read the book of nature. And I put together what I found in this book, A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe.
So, and it's a wonderful book, by the way.
Thank you very much.
if anyone wants a great place to start and continue in the study of sacred geometry, or whatever you want to call that whole arena, this is a fabulous place to peruse both imagery and your very eloquent prose.
Oh, thanks. Well, I wanted to make this subject as accessible as possible, because it is accessible in the simplest terms, really. I didn't want any mathematical background necessary for anybody. So I put it together, lots of pictures, about 500 pictures I counted, about 250 quotes from artists, philosophers, mathematicians, poets, writers, so forth. And there are hardly any numbers, or, I mean, there are no equations in the thing. It's not a mathematical book. It's a fun book. A lot of people just flip through it and read captions or phrases. Other people seriously read right through the thing. I had a lot of fun putting it together.
I can tell. And as you say, it is extremely accessible. It's very easy to get into. And what I found while reading through it, that my childhood sense of awe and reverie for mathematics and number and just the beauty of form was rekindled in every page I looked at.
Well, even before I caught on to the significance of the shapes in nature, I intuitively knew there was something about math that could be interesting, more than just, you know, figuring taxes and measuring bookshelves and so forth, and writing checks. I intuitively knew there was something to it, but had no idea. Nobody taught me. You know, it was all memorize the rules, and, you know, when you're borrowing from a column with a zero in it, you cross that out, make that a nine, and blah, 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 blah. It's, you know, I didn't really enjoy it.
And purely mechanical rather than the divinely inspired, in other words.
Well, in ancient days and all around the world, until not too recently, a deeper understanding of what mathematics and geometry are about, and music, which is number you can hear, what they're inherently about, and whole cultures were designed to move in harmony with the cosmos, and that was expressed through number and shape in not only in ritual but in proportions of architecture and symbolism and mythology, and a lot of it still has come down to us in folk sayings, you know, and folk lore about numbers. All the three wishes and the three tries and the three daughters and the so forth, or the with nine, the number that the ancient Greeks called the horizon number, the ultimate one-digit number. The sayings today express it, dressed to the nines, nine signifying an ultimate horizon, or cat has nine lives, or go the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. You know, we still have this in our culture and within us inherently. We recognize the validity of it because it's
there's a lot of people around here who study the Enneagram as well. I think those kind of things keep coming to the surface in various aspects.
Right. I like the Enneagram particularly. Mm-hmm. The law of three and the law of seven intermixed to look at processes outwardly and inwardly. I like that system. In fact, I've got a section on that in the book, how you can apply that directly to a kitchen or growing plants. Any whole cycle can be represented in nine parts. Hmm. You know, even the cycle of the year in ancient times, many places, was divided into nine parts. That makes nine 40-day cycles. For example, Halloween, which we just recently passed through, comes on the evening before the 40th day after the equinox. You see, so festivals and so forth were structured ritualistically around the calendar and 40-day periods, and the symbolism of 40. You know, rain 40 days and 40 nights, 40 days in the desert, 40 years in the desert. Fally Bob and the 40 Thieves. I mean, there's something to this. They're just not randomly picked numbers, but mm-hmm. they are an inherent code in the past for initiates anyway, to decode what the story was about. 40 represents, 4 and 10. 10 represents a completion, and 4 represents, you might say, the manifestation of. So it's a completion of some kind of physical ordeal or process, you might say. I talk more about that in the book in chapter 4. As you know, each of the each of the chapters, there are 10 chapters, and the book goes through the numbers 1 through 10, therefore, each chapter is about that number, its interesting characteristics.
And they do have personalities.
Actually,
they're very much archetypal, and I think your book eloquently describes those archetypes.
Well, I think arithmetic can be taught to children with the numbers as characters, actually. They do have different characteristics in the way they relate or don't relate to other numbers and so forth. And so each chapter is about that number and the shapes that are represented by that number. 1, the circle. 2, the line. 3, triangle. 4, square. And so forth, up to 10. Although I did put information about 12 and 13 in with chapter 6, because they're so very important and interesting. And the symbolism of them is quite astounding and revealing for understanding cultures around the world and also self-understanding.
Yeah, the 13 is one that crops up in all the lunar cycles, and the 12 tribes of Israel, and the tribe of Levi, and then the 12 disciples, and the Christ figure, and the zodiac, and then the us earthers in the middle, and all those kind of things.
Well, wherever you find 12, you're really going to find a 13th.
Mm-hmm.
It's 12 around 1,
mm-hmm.
All around the world, whether it's the zodiac around the sun, the disciples around Christ, the Dalai Lama and 12 advisors, the 12 labors of, around Hercules that he dealt with, and even George Washington had 12 Freemason generals around him to keep up that symbolism.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's quite remarkable. There's a terrific book on this subject called 12 Tribe Nations, The Science of Enchanting the Landscape by John Michel, that goes into this, how whole nations were organized with a 12 around 1 symbolism. That's why you find somebody finds in Greece, in different towns, the coins, each town's coin has a different zodiacal symbol on it. It'd be a crab on one or a ram on another and so forth. And they put it all together, and they found that the towns were arranged around the sacred center in a zodiacal structure.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like so much of our culture has had that relevance of numbers stripped away from us. And we, like you say, we're taught that the purely what we consider pragmatic aspects are the ones to go for, and the inner revelatory experience with number is not even something that we consider in our curriculum most of the time.
No, it's not taught in school, and number mysticism has a wide reputation, with numerology and so forth. My personal interest is in nature's numerology. I mean, I'm interested in everybody's system. I like I've studied the Greek and the Hebrew and some of the languages that whose alphabets were used as numbers, and so that the names of, say, the Greek gods and goddesses can be represented as numbers, because the letters, you add up the value of the letters. And they have a geometric and mathematical relationship between them that the Greeks built into the names. It's quite astounding. And so that if you were building a temple to a certain god or goddess, you look first at the name and get the number relationships from it, and then you built with those proportions. For example, what shall we say, the name of Demeter in Greek, in classical Greek, and her daughter, Persephone, or Kore, are in the relationship of the side of a square to the diagonal of a square.
Interesting.
Where you look at the numbers and so forth.
A root 2 relationship.
Huh? Mm-hmm. Oh, and Apollo and his sister Artemis. You just simply add up the numbers, and the alphabet is published widely.
Mm-hmm.
Apollo to Artemis is in the golden ratio.
Interesting.
To 2 decimal places.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's totally widespread. I mean, most virtually all the gods and goddesses, nature spirits and so forth, their names are quite revealing. Mm-hmm. You know, the Greeks were geniuses. And they learned it from the Egyptians, who were beyond description.
Mm-hmm. And I was just remembering an interview I did with another friend named Amina, who also goes by Marie Spengler is her name. She goes by Amina, and she lives in Egypt about 9 months of the year. And she has given talks in this area on the Netters, the Egyptian gods and goddesses, mm-hmm. and so forth. And one of the points that she likes to make is that these weren't, you know, idolatry in any sense of the imagination. Their culture, as you pointed out a few moments ago, as many other ancient cultures, were very holistic in their approach to life. And mathematics was not something you could divorce from science or a study of nature. And each of the Netters, rather than being some figurehead put on a pedestal to be worshipped externally, was representative of an inner virtue or an inner quality, and that was deeply entrenched in their culture, and we tend to look down in modern culture to those before us, thinking that all they were doing was just putting these pharaohs on idolatry status and that sort of thing, and in fact apparently nothing could be further from the truth. There was an inner quality that they were revering. Just as you're talking about the inner quality of the numbers, we're representing of the states of consciousness and qualities to embody within ourselves and integrate and harmonize.
No, it's easy to get me started on Egypt.
Why don't we go in that direction then?
Well, I'm a real fan of not only their symbolism and the philosophy of the whole place. Over the different ages, the 33 centuries. But I really love, I have a real passion for looking at the designs of Egyptian jewelry. It sort of snuck up on me. They're such masters and so precise in the geometric and other hieroglyphic and other natural symbolism that they built into these great works of art. And not only, of course, their architecture and crafts, like their crafts as well, but the jewelry is just blows me away with the geometric precision with which they're designed, and particularly the symbolism that they built into it. I'm really in awe when I see what they've done, not only in what you see, but also in the empty spaces as well. It's just astounding. And what I like to do in my workshops is to get people involved in the designs of the arts and crafts and architecture around the world. And so I ask people to bring a geometric compass and a straight edge and something to lean on. And I will show you how to do some of the basic geometric constructions. And then by applying them to the images from Egypt and China and India and Native America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, by applying these constructions to those works of art, you see very clearly how they were designed. And then look further at the symbolism. Why did they choose a triangle or a pentagon or a sphere or a circle? And
what,
so
what
on.
Was the intent behind that, in other words?
What was the intent? Yeah. It was part of, as you say, a holistic attitude. The intent was very important, and to do things that moved in harmony with the natural order process was of supreme importance. And the Egyptians apparently were able to achieve it for the life cycle of that civilization. 33 centuries, you know, I think they were taught something, because the their civilization rose from a very primitive state to an extremely advanced state. In fact, their highest state within a century. It's like nothing had to be developed. Nothing had to go through stages of development. The Egyptologist John Anthony West describes it as it's like the first car ever being invented was not a Model T, but 98 Lamborghini. You know, uh-huh. And Egypt actually went downhill for 33 centuries, but whoa, they were up there for a long time. Even when
that raises a whole raft of other metaphysical questions about our understanding of history and that sort of thing.
Our understanding is I must say...
Our assumptions about history, maybe, is a better way of phrasing it.
It's sort of pathetic. Yeah. I mean, the history that I was taught in school was really even beyond pathetic. It's so stereotypical in the 50s and 60s. And we seem to apply our own limitations to the past. But there was something going on that was extraordinarily wonderful that we glimpse little pieces of. But to see more of the whole is just... awesome.
And how it all ties together. Today we had a lunch together and you were showing me these wonderful overheads of the scarabs and cartouches inscribed within hexagrams, within circles and so forth, and how the alignment of, like you were mentioning, the jewelry, it was so precise. And then a few moments later you were showing me some transparencies of the kivas in New Mexico and Arizona that the Native Americans there were using the exact same hexagonal geometries to portray the square root of three proportions, and how those kind of geometries cut across cultures, across vastly different eras, and the commonality is just really striking.
Well, there's only one set of archetypes to discover. If we're talking archy, the first archetypes, there's a really very limited set, and as Plato pointed out, mathematics is one way, or geometric shapes are one way to approach it. But in a non-intellectual way, necessarily, the intellect gets in the way mm-hmm. of real understanding of this, to discover these principles within ourselves. But it does cut across the world, cultures. This is something I'm finding in common all over. They didn't have to understand that there was a square root of 3 or
right.
1.72 proportion. You can make these things with just two sticks and a piece of string in the sand. That's all you need to do. And it's only recently in the past couple of months where I spent 6 weeks driving around the Southwest, particularly New Mexico and Arizona, Colorado, Utah, the Four Corners areas, investigating the kivas and the geometry of the pueblos and the ancient sites, Chaco Canyon, Mesa Verde, Canyon de Chelly, and so forth, and many much smaller places. I realized that they're using the same geometry that I was finding in Egyptian jewelry and in designs, architecture all around the world. And it occurred to me as I was looking at the public native art that's in all the galleries and so forth there that continue the geometric traditions and the designs, the sand paintings, I realized that this information is being hidden right out in the open.
Some of that reminds me of the quote that's on the back of your book that I just love is, the universe may be a mystery, but it's no secret.
Yeah.
I really like that. I mean, it's just, we were discussing earlier today the idea that perhaps the time has come for the Gnostic and arcane subjects to be really brought out into the open, because I think the world is really ready for a deeper understanding and a remembering, as you point out, of what we've always known all along and what's out in front of us in nature everywhere we look.
Well, I agree. I think there's been a profound change that's come about in the past century, really. And I think it has to do with the public understanding of science. Before radio came along to talk about invisible energies and so forth, or the knowledge of the atom came about. You talk about that and you're likely to be, burnt at the stake. But with the very popular understanding of radio, as we are here, and the common use of electricity and so forth, people are more comfortable with these ideas, and I think that's been part of it. And I also think that people seem to be unfolding at a more accelerated rate. Mm-hmm. Many, many people. And I think it's more dangerous to keep this understanding of the natural order processes hidden than it is to reveal them. Because...
at our ecological peril, for example.
For very immediate example.
Yeah.
It's crucial we understand and cooperate with nature. And that's mm-hmm. in part why I wrote this book, so people could learn to read the messages that are in front of us. I mean, with every three-cornered crack in the sidewalk, that nature is talking to us. And I think it's our responsibility to at least learn to read the language and then to immediately cooperate. Nature's not to be plundered or our adversary at all, but cooperation, and then I think we're in for a cornucopia if that can come about.
Yeah, another concept in your book that I really like is, we're all familiar with the term illiteracy, but innumeracy is one that we don't think of very often, having an appreciation and a respect for the mystery of number within us and how we interconnect, I think is something that puts us in touch with how we can better relate to each other and to our world.
I think children, I agree, I think children should be taught this aspect of mathematics early on without the heavy intellectual memorization of the rules and so forth. That's not what it's about. That's where it's been stripped of number's spiritual nature, the spiritual teachings that come through nature's designs. Some people might say, the garments of the goddess, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But I also see it's not a god or a goddess, but I see an interpenetration of the both is resulting in the manifestation. But this may be far off from the simple alphabet of shapes and patterns. Maybe we should...
You want to talk about the alphabet a little bit?
I'm wondering if any of the listeners can guess which is the most common shape in nature.
Should we do the Jeopardy theme song here? And
da, da, da.
Maybe we should just jump to the answer. Why not?
Shall we do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know you know the answer. We've been talking about this. Many people I've asked think it's a circle or a sphere because there are so many. I mean, if you consider all the planets and the oranges and the grapes and the suns and the bubbles and the foam and all the oceans of the world and all that so forth, spheres. But actually, it turns out that the spiral, the logarithmic spiral, is the most widespread shape in nature. Every atom is a little spiral whirlpool, not to mention all the horns of animals and the seashells and the... Well, look at your own fist and our outer ears and inner ears and heart muscle. And we actually begin life as a spiral embryo. So to my investigation, that's the most common shape.
And the galaxy, of course, too.
Oh, the galaxies.
So like you say, the atom to the galaxy, the microcosm, the macrocosm,
actually, what they
everything
found
in between.
Beyond the galaxies, the galactic clusters actually seem to move in spirals.
Uh-huh.
So it's spiraling galaxies moving within larger, sort of a fractal. There's the fractal universe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And plant tendrils, and butterfly tongues, and so forth and
that's
so
right,
on.
That's
and
right.
I've got the spiral is what made the fifth chapter in the book the largest chapter.
It's a wonderful chapter, too.
It may be my favorite.
That's where I started. I must confess, I like five a lot.
Oh, five is where you went?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've skipped around.
Yeah, that's a quite a lovely number.
Uh-huh.
It's found in... symbolically, it's been used as a symbol of life, of humanity, authority and excellence. You know, the gold star on your paper, but it's the life in the sense that the flower of every edible fruit is five petaled.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, but not every edible fruit has five petals. Wait, did I say that right? Yeah, just as all pennies are coins, but not all coins are.
Okay, we're back again. My name is Bruce Rawls, and with me is Michael Schneider. We're talking about constructing the universe here on KVMR 89.5 FM. You're listening in Nevada City on that frequency, perhaps, and you might be on one of the others, which is 99.3, serving Sacramento with the translator K257DM, or our new translator at 103.7 FM in Auburn, which is K279AE. So thanks to Daniel Holman and Roberta Walker for sharing this last hour with us on the Conscious Cafe.
Yes.
And we were talking about number and the mystical qualities thereof. So why don't we dive back into that a little bit?
Where do you want to go?
Oh, it's so many different directions. Pick a number.
Pick a number. Pick a number 1 through 12 or 13.
Okay. How about 8?
8, number of renewal. It's the kind of number where it shows up in the 8th step of a musical octave, shows up in the number of legs of a spider, which is important in the Native American myths, octopus, 8-sided baptistries, stop signs. What's the message behind it? Well, it has to do with, believe it or not, with the moon and water. That's why you see fountains with eight-sided. To make a long story short, the angle of an eight-sided figure, 108 degrees, is related to the moon in terms of the moon's diameter. Now, this sounds far-fetched, but the ancient units of measure, the foot, the inch, and so forth, even the cubit and so on, were chosen so that there would be an alignment between the distances on Earth and the human body and through the solar system. It's quite a remarkable, you know, why is it that the atomic number of silver, which is the mineral of the moon, shall we say, symbolically, is 108, and the moon's radius is 1080 miles. These were chosen long in the past on purpose. That's why we shouldn't switch to metric. It makes it easier for commerce, but it's a system that I think makes machines out of people. That's a little extreme, but
yeah, there's something nice about the foot divided into 12 equal measures.
Well, 12 is an interesting number. It has more divisors, you know, than any number around it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Go into it, so it's good for organization. Used to be the standard for weights and measures. It still exists to a certain amount. You know, the 12 inches measuring space and the 12 months measuring time. We get that from the Babylonians. Gave us the 60 and the 12. 60 minutes, 60 seconds. It all is related actually to the number of breaths and heartbeats in the human body. All these measures, even though they work out with the Earth and the Moon and so forth, they basically start with the numbers of heartbeats and the numbers of breaths that we have. And this was a standard around the world.
Hmm. That's quite interesting. How about another number? How about 6?
Oh, 6. Lovely number. 1 plus 2 plus 3 equals 1 times 2 times 3 equals 6. It's only 3 numbers in a row that do that.
The triangular number and the factorial, huh?
Oh, something like that. Yeah. It's 6 is a number you see in structure. For example, 6-sided hex nuts, 6 sections in a baseball cap.
Hmm.
6 legs in an insect. And the insects walk on 3 at a time. They walk as if on tetrahedra to get the most stability. They go 3, 3, 3, 3.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, they 6 is a number that provides great stability and structure, you know, the snowflake structure or the hexagonal beehive. Because of that 6-sided shape in the beehive, just a couple of ounces of wax with that structure can hold a few pounds of honey.
It's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, it's 6 is quite an interesting number.
There's something very wonderful too about taking a compass and drawing a circle, then moving the point of the compass to the periphery of the circle and drawing 6 more identical circles and creating what's called the seat of life and finding that when you finish that last circle, you end up precisely where you started on the periphery, and you have this beautiful floral pattern that just about everybody I talk to say, "Oh, I've done that," and so many have launched into a fascination with geometry from doing just that sort of thing. Mm. So,
mm. One of the easiest constructions. The radius of a circle walks around the periphery of the circle precisely 6 times, it's just one of these wonderful mysteries. And it's the basis of many quilt patterns and 6-sided crackers, and all come from that wonderful construction, the Pennsylvania Dutch hex sign. You see it all over the world and through all periods. It's a preeminent geometry that I found in the Southwest. The 6, they have the 6 directions. The 4 cardinal directions of north, south, east, west, and also up and down.
Uh-huh. We have a caller that wants to have you talk about the number 3.
Okay. Is there a question? Or just speak about the number 3. Well, 3 transcends the polarity of 2. When you have 2, you've got 2 opposites. But when you have 3, you have something that has brought them to a new level that they couldn't have achieved on their own. For example, the atoms, every atom beyond hydrogen has 3 parts, the positive and the negative, the proton and the electron, which are oppositely charged, but and they would fly either together or apart were it not for the neutron, which has no charge but brings a stability to the whole. 3 is another name for 1. For example, if you were to braid hair with just 2 strands, you'd just unfurl. But when you bring in that 3rd strand, the 3 interlock as 1. That's why you have tripods, and architects brace up buildings with triangles and so forth. So 3, well, with all the religious trinities around the world, again, the three make a whole. 3 make 1. They interlock. 3, the triangle, is the first shape to actually manifest. 1 being, so let's say, a point. A point is dimensionless by definition. And the line, that, you know, 1 dimension, you can't have, even a string is 2 or 3 dimensions. But the triangle is the first shape to manifest, the first to have an area. So there we have some information about 3. I've got a lot more in the chapter.
Great. Well, we only have a few minutes left, but we've had a flurry of calls. We had one caller wants to know about 13 as a number, and another caller was talking about the floral patterns of ginseng and the 3 and the 5 in those geometries, if you had any experience with those.
Well, I can say about the 13, quite interesting. If you look at the back of a dollar bill with the 2 sides of the United States Great Seal, which is a whole nother hour easily, but if you look at the glory of clouds above the eagle, you'll see 13 stars, 13 5-pointed stars, but they're arranged in a hexagram pattern with 12 around 1. And in fact, at the lecture on December 1st, we'll do some of the geometry on that particular symbol by applying the little geometry that's in the clouds to the whole circle with the eagle. You see how they planned out that symbol. With the 13 and the 13 moons and the part of the inner aspect of it is the 12 meridians of acupuncture around a central meridian. Again, this outer sort of zodiacal symbol is within us. Mm-hmm. With the ginseng, I don't know, but the numbers you mentioned, 3 and 5, are very common in the plant world, the so-called Fibonacci numbers, 3, 5, 8, 13. 3 plus 5 is 8, 5 plus 8 is 13, 13, 8 plus 13 is 21. These are numbers that show up in flower petals, branching patterns, the way fruits appear. It's a very, it leads to a very efficient packaging. It's based on the spiral again, of nature, but it's found throughout the world in art and in the human body and in the plant world. So that's about the three and the five. That's what I can tell you about that. I'd like to know more about the ginseng plant myself. Very interested in plant architecture.
Yeah, it's amazing how many times you find the Fibonacci spiral ratios and sunflower seed spirals, and just everywhere you look, it seems.
The human body. We're at one with all this, and these numbers are just ways to remind us. I think the real work beyond an intellectual understanding of number and shape is to find the principles that they represent, that they symbolize within ourselves.
Definitely.
In awareness, consciousness, because these architects are our own, our native language. And this book was just a fun way to share what I've discovered.
Very fun way. We mentioned again for the listeners that you'll be here on the 1st of December, which is a Monday evening at 7 o'clock at St. Joseph's Cultural Center on Church Street in Grass Valley. And this is an event sponsored by New Frontiers of the Gold Country. We're having free admission for kids, and everyone is encouraged to bring a compass, not the magnetic kind, but the kind with, that you hold in your hand and draw circles with, and a straight edge, and a pencil, and something to draw on, and some paper. And we'll have a portion of the evening will be a hands-on experience, and that'll be a lot of fun.
Oh, that will be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Can I also mention a workshop that
I'm
involved in, an all-day workshop in Mountain View.
Oh, okay.
On November 22nd, is Saturday.
Okay.
It runs from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's at the high school in the two-dimensional art room.
Great. Great. Is there a contact number or somebody can get a hold of for more information?
Yes, there is, but it's not in my pocket at the moment.
Okay.
But
they can call the station here and maybe get your name or vice versa or something like that.
Listeners can call the Mountain View High School.
Oh, okay.
And ask to speak to Karen Koshgarian.
Okay.
Art teacher, and she'll know about it.
Wonderful.
Good friend of mine.
Wonderful. We also have some additional contact information for what you're doing here. I also might mention that Haynes Ely will be interviewing you tomorrow on Earth Mysteries Show for the faithful Earth Mysteries fans.
Hello.
Please tune in tomorrow at noon, and Haynes will continue the dialogue we've been having this evening and perhaps go in totally different directions with the fascinating world of mathematics. We also have a website on the internet devoted to the talk, and that's at www.intent.com/NFGC. And the second item down on that page, you'll find a link to Michael Schneider's talk here. For other information, you can also call Deborah at 477-1141, and she'll be happy to give you more details. But that's basically going to be December 1st, 7 o'clock, St. Joseph's Cultural Center in Grass Valley.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Should be a lot of fun, yeah.
A lot of fun. It's very exciting. Yeah. Great pleasure.
Yeah.
If listeners want, they can email me at geoman@pb.com.
Great.
It'd be fun. I like hearing from people.
Great.
Who are into this.
And we also, earlier today, did a videotape of some of the things we've been talking about and others as well, and that's been airing on FCAT on Channel 11 for those of you in Grass Valley. So you might look for that if you didn't already catch it this evening, perhaps.
Also fun. These conversations are really invigorating.
We've had a very fun day talking about this sort of thing.
I'm really looking forward to the lecture on December 1st over here. I love doing it. I love sharing this, and I'm very glad that children are coming for free. Well, it's minimal cost anyway. But, you know, there have been some young people who have been reading this book. I know of some girls as young as 9 who really, really enjoy it. You don't have to read the whole thing, but there are so many pictures and captions that you recognize the familiar in it, and people seem to really like it a lot.
And it is a wonderful book, and we just had a caller who asked to us to remind the listeners of the name of the book, which is
A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe is published by Harper Perennial. It's in a paperback that feels really good to hold.
It is a wonderful book, and it's by Michael Schneider, who I've been talking
Michael with Schneider
this evening, and what a lot of fun. So, again, thank you, Michael, for being here. And
thank you, Bruce. It's been a great pleasure the whole day, and we'll continue it.
Likewise. And we'll look forward to seeing you on the 1st, and invite our listeners to do their inner explorations with their own mathematical archetypes and see where that might lead them. Mm. And there's so much to explore there.
Very worthwhile.
Very, very indeed. So we'll go out with a little bit more music and wish you all a pleasant evening. Thanks again to Daniel Holman and Roberta Walker for sharing this hour with us, and to all of you listeners who are members of KVMR and those who would like to be or might be motivated to soon become. So you've been listening here in Nevada City at 89.5 FM and in Sacramento at 99.3 FM with translator K257DM and our new translator in Auburn at 103.7 FM, which is K279AE. So have a wonderful evening and take care of yourselves and each other and the world we live in, which is all part of this interconnectedness that we get from exploring these inner dimensions. So have a fond one.